And today we're talking to George Johnson. He's a science writer. He writes for the New York Times, National Geographic, Discover, many other publications. And he's the author of many books. His newest one is called The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery. He will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow night, Tuesday the 3rd of September at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, lest we think that cancer is a disease of the industrial era, it turns out that cancer's been around since the dinosaurs. And it turns out that there are people who are actually experts in dinosaur cancer.
Yes, dinosaur oncology, or more generally, paleopathology. I was amazed to find that little obscure sub-discipline, but yeah, when I learned that early on when I was researching the book, it just really stuck in my mind, and you just see this factoid that's repeated again and again on timelines of the history of cancer about this dinosaur, and you know, sometimes when you look into those things, they turn out to, you can't really track down what the origin is and whether it was real, but I was able to track it down to a paper that ran in the British journal The Lancet, and Bruce Rothschild was the lead author, and he had diagnosed what appears to be a metastatic bone cancer in a fossilized dinosaur bone. And once I corresponded him with a bit and got the story about how this all came to pass and about another doctor who had found the fossil in a rock shop in Colorado, and I just thought, you know, maybe this is the way I should start the book. Partly because no one's going to expect a book about cancer to start with a dinosaur.
Right. Yeah. I love that story about a doctor picks up this bone in a rock shop and says, why, this looks like cancer, of dinosaur cancer.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And if there's cancer in fossilized dinosaur bones, and of course most bones don't survive, and most cancers aren't of the bone, you say, there's a big iceberg under that tip.
Well, yeah, there has to be, because for the cancer to get to the bone, it started somewhere in the dinosaur's soft organs, which, of course, are completely gone. There are, you know, some cancers that originate in bone, like osteosarcoma, but, you know, if the statistics are anything like they are now, something like 90% of fatal cancers are metastatic, you know, meaning that they spread from elsewhere, and that part of the body doesn't tend to get preserved. And
right, and so other animals besides dinosaurs, mammoths and elephants and horses and things like that have also been found, their remains, hundreds, thousands, millions of years old, with signs of cancer.
Yes, right. So it's the question is then, to what extent, I mean, it's clearly not a modern phenomenon, but the extent is, to what extent has it been amplified by the assaults of modern life? And it's a very difficult question. And you can really marshal evidence showing going back very early in hominid history, you know, humans and their close relatives, that you see examples, again, bone cancer. So you have to extrapolate from that. And a few cases in Egyptian mummies, although a myth seems to have been spreading on the internet that there has been no cancer found in Egyptian mummies, and therefore there wasn't cancer back then. But it's actually not true. There's been a few cases, and then there's a lot of reasons why it would be pretty hard to find cancer in a embalmed mummy when you consider the brutal nature of the mummification process. It's not like embalming in a mortuary today.
But again, I mean, there are bones in the archaeological record that show that cancer's been with us in human beings for a very long time.
Yes, one of the most striking examples to me was, it was in Mongolia near, Tuva. Remember, Richard Feynman had this wonderful book called To Tuva or Bust, where he wanted to go to this uttermost part of the world, and somewhere around Tuva in Mongolia, they found a grave of one of the old nomadic kings, they believe, and they excavated the grave, and they found him buried in the bottom with all of his jewels and gold, and alongside a woman. You know, both of them are skeletons now, and the man's body, I think they figured he was perhaps in his 40s you know, from the methods they used to date skeletons. His body was riddled with a metastatic cancer, and it had the pattern that suggested that it might very well have been a prostate cancer. And in fact, later they did the same test that they do now, you know, to determine risk for prostate cancer, and they found out that, sure enough, it came up positive, which, you know, it's not a reliable test, but it's just one more scrap of interesting evidence.
So let's talk about what cancer is. How does a cell go from being a regular cell, doing its thing, participating in the community of the human body, and so on, to being a cancer cell that starts to attack the human body?
Yeah, and it's through mutations. And one number that really is stuck in my mind came from Robert Weinberg, who's a cancer researcher at the Broad Institute at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or the Whitehead Institute. And he did a back-of-the-envelope calculation for me when I asked him, and what it came out to was that every second, 4 million of the cells in your body, and of course there are trillions of cells, but that a fraction of them, of about 4 million, are dividing, you know, just in the normal course of growth and replacement of cells. And every time a cell divides, a healthy cell, 4 million every second, it has to duplicate its entire genome to pass on to its two daughter cells. And then, of course, when they divide, they pass it on. And at each step, there's naturally going to be mistakes and copying errors because, you know, we live in an imperfect world and entropy dominates. So there's always mutations. There's been some estimates are that there'll be maybe a few dozen mutations in each time the cell is copied, or even a few hundred. And most of these are either harmless because, you know, most of the DNA really, you know, is quiescent or junk DNA, and then the other mutations will be so bad that they'll kill the cell outright, and then a few will sneak by, and then some of these might be mutations that basically cause the cell to divide a little faster than its neighbors who don't have this mutation, and then they're going to start growing, you know, larger than the surrounding neighborhood, you know, encroaching on the other cells, and then the other cells will send signals to them, you know, basically saying slow down, you know, these biochemical signals. But say the cell mutates again, in such a way that it learns to ignore the warning signals from its neighbors. So it's like a series of approximately half a dozen mutations for many cancers like this, and all of them really have to occur, but at each step that they do occur, the cell's proliferating that much more rapidly, and therefore more chance for more of these random mutations. So from that perspective, you can look at it as a series of these, from our point of view, deleterious, you know, bad mutations. But if you shift it around and look at it from the point of view of the cancer cell, it's basically doing what a living creature does according to the dictates of Darwinian evolution. It's adapting through random variation, and it's being selected so that the cells that adapt in a way that make them stronger than the other cells are flourishing and surviving, and they're becoming fitter and fitter to our great detriment.
Not knowing that by doing that, they will eventually cause their own death anyway.
Well, yeah, it's fairly short-sighted of them, but, you know, there was some point when I was working on the book when it really struck me how much this was like a little quasi or would-be creature, like a hopeful monster trying to evolve within the ecosystem of your body. And this is what makes it different from other diseases, and it's what it's made it just so intractable. And for all that has been learned about the nature of how this works, how little of that is translated into effective treatments for advanced cancers particularly.
We're talking to George Johnson about his new book, The Cancer Chronicles. One of the things that I think is just so interesting and I think important to talk about is, like, if you have an infectious disease, you've got polio or a urinary tract infection or whatever, yellow fever, the flu, it's a bacterium or it's a virus. It has its own characters, has its own genes. If you have cancer, it's you. It's your cells, and it's a mutant you. But what's kind of puzzling or interesting to me is that these cancers, like, let's say you have bladder cancer in humans has a very similar character among all humans.
Yes, and there's definitely types that seem to depend somewhat on the tissue and the nature of the mutations, and it's not well understood, and they're starting more and more not to classify cancers according to the organs where they begin, because they're finding so many of the same mutations in the different organs. That was just kind of a convenient way. And yet, for terms of treatment, you know, it can be very helpful to know, I mean, it can be crucial to know the origin of the cancer. But to get back to what you said about the difference with infectious diseases, that's just a really striking point. Because, you know, the great triumphs of modern medicine, you know, modern going back to, like, say, the late 1800s and early 1900s, has been discovering that so many diseases are caused by these microscopic infectious agents, and then learning to combat them through vaccination or better sanitation, and or through antibiotics. And the result has been, you know, really reducing by vast numbers some of the historically the worst scourges of humankind, you know, the Black Death, for example. And we've become locked into really thinking of diseases like that, the invader from without instead of the invader from within. And you find when people, when you get cancer, if you're diagnosed with cancer, it's hard to break out of that old mind frame. You find yourself thinking, what happened to me? What came from the outside that gave me this cancer? And sometimes that is a contributing factor. You know, certainly if you were exposed for long periods of time to ionizing radiation, like radium or a lot of medical radiation, or certain chemical carcinogens, if you just were, you know, drinking water chronically or eating food for years and years that had chemicals that encouraged mutations in cells, this would increase your rate of cancer. But it's not clear that those really are the cause of more than a very small fraction of cancers, and that's what the epidemiology seems to show, and it's been one of the big surprises of the last 30 years.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there's so much going on in the media about preventing cancer, about genetic predispositions to cancer, about all the things in our diet, in our environment, and so on that cause cancer. And yet, if you take all of those things, it's still the minority of all cancers.
Yeah, you could eliminate, you know, all of the chemical carcinogens from Earth, and there would still be a background rate of cancer. It's just, you know, one of the unfortunate things that's built in as an evolutionary trade-off. And and as far as, you know, inherited cancers, where you inherit the bad genes, so if you think of a cancer as being a string of mutations, and all these mutations happening all the time, but one of them will win the lottery, or you'll lose the lottery from our perspective, and that collection of mutations will cause the cell to become malignant and then metastatic, while in most cases by far that won't happen. But if you inherit some of the mutations to begin with from your parents, you obviously have a head start, which is the case with the mutations of the BRCA gene that were in the news because of the Angelina Jolie story.
Right.
But again, in those cases, the epidemiology seems to indicate that maybe 15% of all cancers have an inherited factor like that. So again, that's not a lot of them. You know, it's horrible when they happen. And there are, like, the infectious agents play a role in the sense that some viruses are able to, you know, like human papilloma virus can actually smuggle its genes into the healthy cells, and this can help, you know, tip the cell toward becoming a cancer cell. So, I mean, that's one of the few cancers where you can really combat it by going after an infectious agent through vaccination and hygiene and early detection. And that's probably going to be one of the, it's already becoming one of the great success stories in cancer prevention is controlling HPV virus. On the other hand, there's hardly any evidence that eating a diet heavy with fruits, vegetables, and grains helps very much at all. It doesn't hurt. There's other good reasons to do that, but...
Yeah, it does keep you healthy in other ways.
Yeah. But you shouldn't do it... Well, maybe I shouldn't say shouldn't. You can do it and think that, and maybe the positive attitude will help, but there's just very little evidence that it makes much difference. And that's a huge change from the 1990s when all these studies came out that seemed to indicate a huge effect from that kind of diet. And it was the early epidemiology, and then later more refined studies came, and it, you know, all but overturned it. It was, you know, it's very discouraging because, you know, you want to find something so you think you can do it and you'll increase your odds, and it's probably not one of them, or it's not a big one.
Well, I mean, we want to be in control of our lives in some way.
Yeah.
And in a world where there's so many ways in which we don't feel in control.
So much of it comes down to randomness. And one thing I wrote, it was a blog post I did for Discover Magazine, and the headline was, the most powerful carcinogen is entropy, just the natural tendency of all complex creatures to become increasingly disordered. And you know, over the millennia, evolution has equipped bodies with an amazing ability to fend off a lot of, you know, entropy for a long time, and that includes all kinds of cellular mechanisms that detect mutations.
Well, and that's another thing that I think is very important to talk about. Our bodies are naturally fighting cancer all the time.
All the time, yeah. It's generally believed that that at any moment in anyone, there's little cancers trying to get their start, and they're being, you know, quashed very quickly, either by the immune system or by some of the safeguards built into the cell. So there's some really neat thing in cellular biology called the Hayflick limit, named after a scientist named Hayflick, who figured that, on average, it varies for cells, but ballpark figure is that a cell can divide 50 times, 50 generations, copying its DNA before a little built-in counter, you can almost think of it as, basically triggers and says, okay, your time is up, and then it initiates apoptosis, which is programmed cellular suicide, and the cell just kind of sets off all these little microscopic depth charges inside itself, and, you know, poof, it's gone before it can cause any problems. But one of the things that cancer cells learn to do, you know, quote-unquote, around learn, is that they mutate and they develop a enzyme that allows them to basically defeat the counter. It all has to do with something you've probably read about called telomeres and telomerase. And it's a big, big hot topic of research.
Well, and that's another thing, is that there is so much research going on. I mean, just during your and my lifetime, huge strides have been made in the understanding of cancer, and you've got not only biologists and doctors, but you've got computer scientists, mathematicians, physicists, all trying to understand this in different ways.
Yeah. And
are there new models that they're coming up with of cancer, of what it is, how it works?
I mean, still the basic model that almost everyone accepts is called the monoclonal theory. You know, when a clone is basically, it's not really the way it's used there, it's not what we think of when we read about clones in the news like Dolly, although it's closely related. So a clone in that sense is a cell and all of its progeny, you know, that have the same genome, except for the little errors that inevitably occur. So the idea of monoclonal, single cell theory of cancer is that one cell starts dividing, and as it produces progeny, and the progeny accumulate mutations, and their progeny accumulate more mutations, that you get to the point where in a certain fraction of cases, you'll have one cell that hits the magic combination, or one of the many magic combinations that make it go cancerous. So that's really the dominant view. And then there's some alternate views that are, they don't contradict that, but they're kind of footnotes, like the stem cell theory of cancer, where there are actually certain cells that are much more likely to spread a cancer than others. And then as far as like ideas further out, there was one that Paul Davies, the physicist at Arizona State University, has been writing a lot about, which is the idea that cancer consists of cells reenacting these programs that were built into the cell way back early in evolution and aren't really supposed to be turned on anymore. So like, you know, back in the days when there were single cells and there were not multi-celled creatures, metazoans as we call them, and that...
Which is most of the history of life on Earth.
Most of the history of life on Earth, yeah. And a single cell, you know, in the primal muck is supposed to, you know, replicate like crazy and produce its progeny under the imperatives of, you know, spreading its genetic legacy. And, of course, some of the cells will, you know, push back, but they were all still semi-independent entities. And
there was no downside to really proliferating as much as possible.
No, yeah, probably not, unless there was some way that you were dependent on the other single cell creatures around you, which, you know, you can imagine that there were some symbioses and things that would kind of act in a very primitive way, how in a multicellular organism there are these built-in safeguards to keep a cell from basically striking out on its own and trying to evolve within the body.
So, in a way, these cancer cells are striving for immortality in some way. They don't want to be turned off. They don't want to go through this natural process of having a life cycle and then going through apoptosis, which means dying when it comes their time to die.
Yeah, yeah. They learn to defeat all of those natural mechanisms and become immortal until the human dies. So that's the limit. And one of the things that interested me is, so as these cancer cells are evolving in your body, you know, they're getting, you know, smarter and smarter.
Defeating the medicines that are trying to kill them.
Yeah, they're evolving around the different chemotherapies and learning to be resistant to radiation. So, you know, you just can't resist personifying the cancer cell and using all these improper language like learning. But it just... You know, scientists lapse into that too because it's just such a natural way to describe it. But of course, it's all done through random variation and selection within the body. But yeah, so they're going off on these trajectories, and yet the evolution stops when they finally end up killing the host and defeat their own purpose. So, you know, it raises the question of what if cancer cells could jump outside of a body, get into another body, and continue to evolve, and then there would be nothing stopping them. And contagious cancer, which is
that science fiction, or do we have that?
Well, it's right on the border. There are contagious cancers that are known among dogs, in particularly canine transmissible. I don't have the name right in my head, but it's in the book. and then there have been and then there's the Tasmanian devils. You know, there's this cancer that the cancer cells are passed from one Tasmanian devil to another when they you know, viciously attack each other and bite each other's mouths. And these are not cases where a virus is being, you know, transferred from one organism to another, like with HPV and cervical cancer. This is actually a case where the actual cancer cell is going from one creature to another and then continuing the cancer. Now, the only known human cases are accidents in laboratories where a cancer worker had some, you know, cancer cells in an injectable, you know, glassware of some form, a syringe, and accidentally maybe stabbed herself or himself with that, and then had... you know, maybe like a liver cancer growing in their skin. which, you know, presumably could be removed pretty quickly since you knew something horrible had happened. So it's conceivable, and, you know, cancer cells have evolved within the body to the point where they can jump from places to places and new ground in the body. So it, you know, it raises the question of whether they could take another leap. And David Quammen wrote a really excellent article for Harper's Magazine years ago called Contagious Cancer that got the National Magazine Award, I think. And it's just a stunning piece of work.
We're talking to science writer George Johnson about his new book, The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery. How has cancer been described historically? What are the earliest records that we have of cancer and its treatments?
When you go back to Hippocrates, and even before that, there's some Egyptian papyruses, and is that how you say it? Papyruses?
Papyri.
And they're interpreted by a lot of medical scholars as hinting at cancer, and, you know, describing cancer, but then it's very ambiguous. They talk about swellings of the flesh and eatings, and then there's others who argue that, well, you know, they could just as easily be talking about, you know, like a really bad infectious lump or something. But by the time you get to Hippocrates, that's when you got the image of cancer as, well, you know, cancer comes from the word for crab, you know, and the Crab Nebula and all that, you know, the same linguistic origins. And, you know, it's basically thought that, you know, it was because he looked at cancer in patients he was treating and then thought that it resembled a crab. But then other people have pointed out, including Siddhartha Mukherjee in his, you know, really great book, Emperor of All Maladies, that actually cancer doesn't really look very much like a crab at all. So there are some alternative theories now about why this term might have arisen and then caught on. So I won't go in. They get very abstruse, but yeah, it's something I couldn't resist getting into in the book.
And were there treatments, I mean, effective or ineffective in kind of pre-20th century history?
Yeah, well, I don't know how effective they were, but there was a great, great quote that I should have memorized it. It's something like, you know, for cancer, or maybe I can I find it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and, here we go. This is from Hippocrates. So some of the treatments, Greek texts describe what sound like cancer of the uterus and cancer of the breast, and, you know, they believed in sympathetic magic, and so some physicians would treat a tumor by placing a live crab on top of it. And,
right.
And then they recommended powders and ointments that were sometimes made from pulverized crabs, and the idea that, you know, there was some linguistic connection, and, you know, with sympathetic magic that maybe this would take the tumor out. So I bet that probably didn't work so well. And they would use cauterization, you know, as if they were, you know, burning close an ulcer, which, you know, at best would be a temporary remedy. But then this is what struck me from Hippocrates. He said, with treatment, he warned that for patients with internal tumors to leave them alone. Like, you could try treating skin tumors and things with pulverized crabs or cauterization, but if the tumors were inside the body, which is most of them, to leave them alone. So he says, with treatment, they soon die, whereas without treatment, they survive for a long time.
So meaning the people with treatment basically kills the patient.
Right. Because, you know, the treatment, of course, it's still so brutal for most cancers, and it would have been even more brutal then. And there's also a quote from an Arab scholar from saying, when a cancer has lasted long and is large, you should not come near it. I've never been able to save any case of this kind, nor have I seen anyone who has been successful. And then I comment on his comment, it's not so different now.
It's not so different now. And that's one of the things that I think is so humbling to us today, is that treatment hasn't really changed that much in the last several decades. We have chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery.
Yeah.
And cancer still is very hard to get rid of. Almost nobody says that they've been cured. They will say that it's in remission.
Right.
And are there any breakthroughs on the horizon of really different approaches?
Well, right now, and one of the frustrating things for both cancer researchers and oncologists, the doctors treating cancers, and especially for the patients themselves, is how slowly and how rarely these great discoveries in the laboratories are making their way into effective treatment. So now, if you're diagnosed late with, like, say, a stage 4 metastatic cancer, the treatment hasn't really changed very much in concept for years. There's some details have changed, but they hit it with, you know, chemotherapy, which are basically poisons that, you know, go after all the cells in your body. But since the cancer cells are dividing at a faster rate, they bear the brunt of the damage, you hope, and they have less ability often to repair themselves as the healthy cells. So you know, an oncologist is just kind of an expert on poisoning you to the brink and hoping that the cancer, you know, has been beaten back when they bring you, you know, back to health. And then radiation is the same concept, except using ionizing rays. So there have been refinements, you know, with that, what they call brachytherapy and radiation treatments, where you'll implant, you know, a little tiny pellet of radium, you know, near a tumor to, you know, so it doesn't, you're not like blasting the whole area of the body. And radiation, just the way they aim and target it, has become very refined. But still, it's this very crude blunderbuss kind of way to treat cancer. And, you know, the talk is, you know, you're always hearing about these targeted therapies, and targeted in the sense that this was a therapy that would go right directly to the cancer cell, affect the cell, and nothing else. And everyone is very hopeful after the invention of Gleevec, which is, you know, the drug that's used in a certain kind of leukemia, and that's been extraordinarily effective in just almost eliminating mortality from what used to be would be sure death. But the thing about Gleevec is you have to keep taking it indefinitely, and then some people do develop resistance to it, but still, it's a huge success. It's often called the poster child of targeted therapies, but that was quite a while ago. And since then, there's been Herceptin, which is a targeted therapy for certain kinds of breast cancer. And it can be very effective in early-stage primary breast cancers. But as far as metastatic cancers that are already spreading, and especially if they've advanced to, say, stage 4, you're really just buying months of life. And there's just hasn't been a leap beyond that. And there's been news recently about some things that sound interesting, where they'll take immune cells out of your body and essentially reprogram them by changing their DNA so that they're more adept at fighting your particular cancer and putting those back into the cells. And though there was a good piece a couple years ago, I think in the New Yorker, by Jerome Goodman, and other stories since then, but in the New York Times. But again, you know, it's a highly experimental treatment. They've tried it on a few patients, you know, and it's been, you know, mixed success. But, you know, it seems like it can only get better as we learn more about the disease, but at a frustratingly slow pace. And, of course, they're sequencing the cancer genome, so they can find out, in theory, if someone has cancer, they could take their cells, sequence the genomes, and find out just which mutations are causing the cancer.
Because there are mutations that are common to all kinds of different people.
There's really definitely a taxonomy of a certain finite number of mutations that they find that are causing cancer. And some promote the cell to divide too fast, and some of them defeat so-called tumor suppressor genes, which send out chemicals to slow the cell down, and then the genes that enable a cell to make telomerase, so it can defeat the little telomere counters, so it can bypass the Hayflick limit. But, you know, of course, there's many mutations yet to be discovered. And one of the difficulties is when you sequence a cancer genome, you'll find hundreds, maybe thousands of mutations. And it's probably only a fraction of those are actually have anything to do with the cancer, because at that point, you know, the cell has just been dividing like crazy and all of these controls have broken down. So it's mutating like mad, including mutations that may just be coming along for the ride. We call them passenger mutations. So the big challenge is to distinguish between the driver mutations and the passenger mutations.
We're talking to George Johnson about his book, The Cancer Chronicles. We talked about radiation and ionizing radiation from, for example, X-rays and nuclear radiation from Fukushima, that kind of thing. Those things are very bad for you. They are carcinogenic. What about, there's so much talk about cell phones and cell phone towers and things like that. What is, from all the research that you've done and all the research that you have observed, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I actually begin a chapter describing that and an experience I had when I was writing about the controversy in the Santa Fe Review, which is an online publication that's kind of lapsed into into a coma in the last few years. And then I also wrote an article for Slate about this when it was, you know, one of the times when it was a big hot topic. But, I mean, you don't have to be completely crazy to believe that cell phones might cause brain tumors, but the evidence is just between non-existent and extremely scant. And if they do, it would mean that there's something really basic that we don't understand about both physics and about cancer. Both of those things are possible, but when you look at it in the bigger perspective, the epidemiology, is there a rise in the number of brain tumors over the years? No, there's not. In fact, the numbers remain very steady, and again, there's counterarguments to that. You can say, well, wait 50 years. Maybe the mutations are just accumulating very slowly, but I think it's fair to say that most researchers, oncological researchers, would be astonished if it turned out that cell phones had anything to do with cancer. The main difference between that radiation and radiation from Fukushima is ionizing radiation versus non-ionizing radiation. And non-ionizing radiation, which is the same that comes from not just a cell phone, but a light bulb. You know, it's what comes from your radio. It's radio waves. Everything. It's radiation that's of such a low frequency and therefore such a low energy that it doesn't have the ability to break molecular bonds. And it's by doing that you mutate DNA. Now again, there are some counter arguments. You know, you can cause a mutation indirectly. You know, the field of epigenetics is very hot, where certain chemical reactions outside a cell, and that would also include possibly non-ionizing radiation, might skew the chemistry in the cell in such a way that it causes more oxidation, you know, oxygen, free oxygen radicals, and those could conceivably indirectly damage the DNA. So it's not science fiction, but it's just not being borne out in the studies.
So perhaps one less thing to worry about?
Yeah, I mean, if anyone smokes cigarettes and is worried about the effect of their cell phone, it's...
Right. And if they smoke cigarettes and have had high exposure to uranium and things like that, those synergistic effects, as you write, are also very serious.
No, that's true. That's true. I mean, I hate cell phones as much as anybody. I think they're a social abomination, but I don't think it's very likely that they give you brain tumors. It just sort of seems like it does sometimes. And
now, cancer, which, as you talked about, has, it almost has like a kind of monstrous persona. I mean, my father died of cancer when I was 18, and we saw other cancer patients, and there was a kind of, it was like being in a horrible fiction of this invader. Part of the story that you wrote in the Cancer Chronicles is the story, I mean, you were married to a woman who at the age of 43 was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic uterine cancer. Horrible story, horrible disease, horrible treatment, and she survived.
Yeah, it'll be 10 years in October since the initial diagnosis, which is just a wonderful thing. We're no longer married, but she was very helpful when I was writing the book, and I asked her to read all the chapters. So I tell her story, and I weave it through the book, as you saw, as kind of a narrative backbone and a way to hold the science together, and I ask her to read the sections to make sure that our memories accorded with each other's, and to make sure there wasn't anything that she'd feel uncomfortable being in the book. But I was extraordinary. I mean, back then when we learned, it was a cancer called uterine papillary serous carcinoma, which is very similar to ovarian cancer as far as its viciousness, and it showed up in a lymph node, and there was no sense originally that where it came from in the body. It might have been colon cancer, it might have been stomach cancer. All that was known is that it had metastasized to a lymph node, and it took, you know, another few weeks of tests to narrow it down to its origin before they could start about treatment. And then it was the whole brutal regime of surgery, intense chemotherapy, intense radiation. And it seems to have worked, which is wonderful. The according to one paper, the 5-year survival rate for that cancer was between 5% and 10%. So
she was one of that number.
Yeah.
And then you write about your brother, who had a very small tumor. Everyone thought it could be treated. He was a very positive person with tremendous faith, and it got to him.
Yeah, he was. It was a cancer that's usually treatable and defeatable. It's called squamous cell carcinoma of the head and neck, and it can be very, very vicious and aggressive. In this case, it was, but it's generally considered, you know, one you can overcome. But he was diagnosed, and within 9 months, he was dead. He just went from being a completely, completely healthy person to dying like just 2 days after Christmas, dying at home because there was pretty much decided after his third round of chemo and there had been radiation as well that there was nothing more they could do, and the treatment was only hastening his death. And it's just a horrible thing.
You don't write much about alternative and non-Western treatments.
Yeah, well, no, and I mean, if they worked just the way the nature of the world is, there would be Seba Geigy or someone would have come on to it. They would figure out a way to tweak a molecule there and patent it, and they would be making a lot of money on it. And there's no controlled double-blind studies that show that any of these things are particularly effective.
But, and so,
and of course, they're also dangerous if they keep people from seeking other treatments. But then, I don't know, as soon as I say it, I think, you know, if the other treatment is going to be, you know, killing rounds of toxic chemicals and radiation for a stage 4 cancer that's going to kill you anyway, I mean, you know, that wouldn't be such an easy decision. And you know, of course, there's also the placebo effect. Having a good attitude is supposed to be very helpful, and there's studies showing that stress actually, you know, increases all kinds of vulnerabilities, including the vulnerabilities to cancer. So you could argue that, you know, happy, stress-free, stress-free life and believing in your treatment and being optimistic in itself could help. But so little
it doesn't seem like it. It doesn't seem like that's the case. I mean, the way you describe your brother was as being the most positive person ever.
Well, that's what was so heartbreaking. Like, you know, right to the end, he was sending emails to the family and, you know, just talking about how so many people were praying for him, and he had great faith in God, and I had no idea that my brother was such a religious person, and he was and had been, you know, long before the cancer. But and then he'd go through some brutal round of treatment, and he'd be back at the hospital, and they'd find something, and he'd say, "Oh, I'm sure it's going to be nothing. The doctors say it's probably just a bit of mucus in my throat." And then the next email the next day would be, "Well, it's another tumor, but they can defeat this one. You know, they just have to do this and this." And it was just so heroic, the way I can't imagine facing it with the courage and optimism that he did.
So much of the experience of cancer is about fear. There is fear of getting cancer that you really feel palpably in the media, you know, the kind of like, here's what you can do to prevent cancer and things like that. And, you know, fear of all these things that might give it to us, fear of pain, fear of death when people do get it, fear of the treatments.
Yeah.
And there are so many responses that people have to this fear. We search for meaning. We search for patterns. Why did I get this? Why did my beloved person get this? And yet it seems that there's just so much randomness.
Yeah.
I mean, a total unpredictability.
That's what makes it so hard to accept. You know, you want to think, first, if someone else gets cancer, you want to think, well, there's something they did wrong that I can avoid and I won't get it. Or if you get it, you know, part of you thinks, oh, God, I must have done something horribly wrong. If only I had eaten this or eaten that. And then there's also the sense of figuring that it must be something you can blame on something from the outside, whether it's, pollution in the atmosphere or whether it's your cell phone and things. So, you know, the brain is hardwired, you know, for very good reasons. We survived and prospered through evolution because of an amazing ability to find patterns and to see cause and effect, but we're also cursed with the seeing cause and effect when it's not even there, and cursed further with not being able to tell the distinction often. So yeah, you want to think that, you know, something happened to you, but then it's not like, with few exceptions, it's not like the model of infectious diseases. You know, the exceptions being the 10% of cancers worldwide that are believed to be caused by viruses. And, you know, there's great hope of, you know, really reducing that number, which is already happening in the developed world. And then if they can just get these vaccines to the developing countries.
It's just about time to go. You dedicated this book to your brother's family, and there was a very nice epigraph that you included. Could you read that to us?
Yes, this is from the writer Primo Levi. He said, "We must never feel disarmed. Nature is immense and complex, but it is not impermeable to intelligence. We must circle around it, pierce and probe it, looking for the opening or making it."
George Johnson is a science writer. His new book is The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery. He will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Tuesday, the 3rd of September at 6 in the evening. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for inviting me.